So Thibodeau goes to Boudreaux and he said, you know, me and my wife Clotilde, boy, we had it out last night, Sheriff. He said, I bet Clotilde did it on you. He said, oh no, let me tell you something, Boudreaux. Let me tell you how the evening ended. Evening ended her coming to me crawling on her hands and knees. Boudreaux said, what'd she say? Thibodeau say, she say, get out from under that bed, you coward. Speaking of battles, today we look at the first conquest of history. We went through a long session, actually three studies, on the era of consolidation, 2000 BC to about 600 BC. During that long interval, not much of great significance happened. There was not great movement of peoples. Today we look at the first major conquest in human history, and it was in the year 722 BC. You don't have to be a math major to know I just contradicted myself. I said a long era of consolidation, with nothing much happening, 2000 BC to 600 BC, but the first major conquest was 722 BC. Actually, the first conquest of the world was 722 BC. Accepted history does not include it as a major conquest. So the 2000 BC to 600 BC, that's the accepted realm of world history. You don't find anything. But there was a conquest that happened in the year 722 BC. You'll find it in history books. It's one of those you might find in a footnote. But actually, what happened in 722 BC was that the nation of Assyria conquered the nation of Israel. The reason it's not really treated in history is because it was just one Shemite nation conquering another Shemite nation. So it's not seen. It's a very minor event. But, as we've been seeing so many times, if you look at world history through the biblical perspective, you find that many of those little minor, insignificant events have great significance. And not just in the Bible. They impact the history of the world. And if you're not looking at history through the biblical worldview, we'd miss them. Because this conquest in 722 BC is very important, mainly because it's a picture of how God deals with nations, how God deals with human beings, specifically on this whole concept of judgment. There's a lot of misunderstandings in the world about God and judgment. I guess there are two main extremes. One view is that God doesn't judge people. He's kind of a kindly old grandfatherly type up in heaven. And he doesn't judge anybody. Second concept is, like that cartoon you see on your handout, God at any time has got his computer screen in front ready to hit that smite button. Here's some poor schmuck walking along and God's going, ha 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 ha, look up, pal. Smite, and down it crashes. And for the record, let me say that's a Far Side cartoon by Gary Larson entitled God at His Computer, Copyright Creators Syndicate. So we have two extremes. God doesn't judge anybody, and God's just sitting there gleefully at the smite button, ready to strike people. I believe, actually, most unbelievers picture God as kind of a grandfatherly old man who doesn't judge anybody, and I think most believers think he's there at the smite button. And before we go on, so there's no misunderstanding, let me just define what I mean the rest of the lesson by believer and unbeliever, just in case there's any misunderstanding on that issue. Let me approach it this way. If you believe that there is a God, maybe he's involved in our lives, he'll reward the good people, he'll punish the bad people, good people go to heaven, my good works outweigh my bad, if I'm a good moral person, I live a good life, I'll go to heaven. You're not a believer. A believer is someone who does not have specifically a continuing emotional feeling towards God. A believer is somebody who at one time with his will has said, I choose to believe that when Jesus died on the cross, he died for my sins. If you've done that, you're a believer. If you haven't, you're an unbeliever. It's pretty much as simple as that. Now the first conquest, in this first conquest of history, hidden in history, we see very clearly this whole concept of judgment as it pertains to God. And the way I want to begin today is point out that God normally does not directly judge people. That part's true. In fact, Isaiah 28:21, Isaiah, speaking of judgment, he calls it his work, his strange work. So when God directly judges, it is unusual. So he's not sitting there at his keyboard ready to hit the smite button all the time. In fact, it's very odd, the pattern of judgment. Jesus himself said in John 5:22, Jesus said, as a rule, the Father doesn't judge anyone, but he has given all judgment to the Son. So we say, well, okay, God the Father doesn't judge. He gave it all to Jesus. Then in John 8, Jesus says, I don't judge anyone, but there's judgment going on. Two things we're going to see today. One, he normally doesn't judge. Normally people judge themselves. But sometimes he does hit that smite button directly. And today we're going to see why he does it. So 722, Assyria conquered Israel. Let's look at both. First, let's look at Assyria. Where did Assyria come from? We go back, as we do so many times, to Genesis chapter 10. Remember, that's the chapter that tells where everybody came from. The sons of Shem. Who were the sons of Shem in general? The Arabs and the Jews. Elam, Asher, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram. See the word Asher there? The son Asher? That became Assyria. Now Arpachshad and Lud became folded into Asher, and Aram became the nation of Syria, just to the north of Israel. These were all Semites. Now in 2500 BC, the beginning of the historical era, most of these Semites were over in Mesopotamia, later to be known as Babylon. And the first movement of history began 2500 BC when those Semites in Babylon moved northwest to an area you see on your handout, which is called Assyria. It wasn't called Assyria then, but here's what happened. Over in Mesopotamia, in the city of Ur, there was a family of Semites, and the father was Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, this migration of the Semites from Babylon up to Assyria actually began with Terah's son, Haran. He moved up there, and then Terah brought the whole family. Genesis 11:31, Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans, that's Mesopotamia, in order to enter the land of Canaan. But they didn't go all the way. They went as far as Haran and settled there. That's where the Assyrian nation began, with Ashur, and then Terah, and his son Haran. Now, for a while, it wasn't a nation yet, that group of Semites, who would later become the Assyrians, were a great benefit. For example, Isaac and Jacob both got their wives from that area. But in time, they became more isolated from their other Semites, and these Assyrians became evil, and they became very cruel. I can't tell you how cruel they were. Barbarically cruel. And unfortunately, that empire began to greatly expand. And by 750 BC, the Assyrians had totally conquered the area of Mesopotamia, and now it's known as Babylon from now on. 750 BC, the Assyrians have conquered Babylon, and very quickly they conquer Syria. That would be just northeast of Israel on your map there. They were a powerful empire. No one could touch them. If you want a name from history, Sargon II was the emperor of the Syrian Empire at this time, and he was a terror. He struck fear in people. That's Assyria. Now, at Israel, what happened in Israel? Well, we remember that there was a united kingdom for a while under Saul, David, and Solomon, about the year 1000, round number. Solomon did some wonderful things with government. He did what governments are supposed to do. He established strong defense and military. That's what governments are supposed to do. He protected his people. That's what they're supposed to do. But then he started taxing the people out of control. The federal government became by far the biggest employer in all of Israel. As I said before, I'm glad we've learned our lesson, and that never happens anymore. But under Solomon, the federal government by far was the largest employer. It was a tax and spend system. He dies. His son Rehoboam becomes the king. The older people came to him and said, hey, Re, that's what they called him. So listen, your government's out of control. You got to cut your taxes. We're going under. Young guy said, we recommend a tax and spend program and keep doing it more. It's good for us. It'll stimulate. He took the wrong advice. Almost a civil war broke out. But God stepped in, moderated it, but God let the kingdom split into two. And Jeroboam became the king of the northern kingdom, which became known as Israel. And Rehoboam continued as the king of the southern kingdom, which became known as Judah. If you want a round number, put 930 B.C. If you want an exact number, put 927 B.C. Northern kingdom had 19 kings, almost all wretched. A couple of good ones when Elisha was the prophet. Northern kingdom had 19 kings. Southern kingdom had 20 kings. Some good, some bad. When I say bad and good, I mean by good, they were looking for the Messiah for their salvation. By bad, I mean they were into idolatry. 2 weeks, we'll look at Judah. Today, I want to focus on Israel. Jeroboam started off great by establishing a golden calf and said, here's your God you're going to worship. He was off to a good start. And then it got worse. By the time of Ahab, about the year 870 B.C., and his lovely, lovely wife Jezebel, they introduced Baal, kept disintegrating and disintegrating. There was a little window where there was hope during the ministry of Elisha. But when Elisha died, it was all over. The northern kingdom kept deteriorating and deteriorating until 722 B.C. God stepped in, and yes, he hit the smite button. He did his strange work of judgment. But we don't ever want to connect wrong dots. God did not judge Israel because they were worshiping Baal, because they were idolaters, because they were evil. If that's why God judged people, it wouldn't be a strange work. He'd be judging people all the time. He didn't judge Israel because of how evil they were. We don't ever want to think that. He doesn't do that. That's not how he judges, and that's not why he judges. And that's why this conquest of Assyria over Israel is so important, that we understand why God judged Israel. You see, I'm afraid people set up kind of a logical syllogism in their minds. The major premise is God judged Israel. The minor premise is Israel was God's people. And the conclusion is, therefore, God judges his people. It's logical, isn't it? God judged Israel. Israel was God's people. Therefore, God judges his people. Now, whether we make it in the form of a logical syllogism, I guarantee you there's something in that thinking that's corrupted us. We see examples where God judged them. They were his people. Therefore, God does judge his people. Whenever we have issues like that, first thing we do is, even if we don't understand, where do we go to get our doctrine? New Testament epistles. Do we get our doctrine from stories, even if they're true? No. We don't get our theology, our doctrine, from syllogisms, even if they make logical sense. We get our doctrine from the New Testament. What do the New Testament epistles say about judgment? For example, Romans 8:1. How about there is no judgment for those in Christ? So if someone says, well, what about this? Even if you don't understand it, if you have to do this, I'm not listening, and just say Romans 8:1, I'm not judged. But here we do know why God judged Israel. It's not why we would think. And all we have to do is read the so-called minor prophets. Really not a fair term. It's not like they're lesser than the major prophets, just that their books are smaller. I actually always liked them for that reason when I was in Sunday school. I preferred the minor prophets. But in general, the major prophets were directed to Judah. We'll look at it in a couple of weeks. And in general, the minor prophets were directed towards the northern kingdom of Israel. The minor prophets being Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum. Starting with Hosea and go to Nahum in your Bible, and those are the minor prophets. Now, I'm going to look at an overview of some of the minor prophets, but first let me tell you five facts we learn about God's judging Israel that we get from the minor prophets. Then I'll give you some examples of the minor prophets. The first fact is God did judge Israel. Here's the second fact. The judgment was confined to the leaders and rulers. 3, God's judgment did not harm the believers. In fact, 4, God's judging Israel was for the protection of those believers. And point five, God's judging benefited not only Israel, but God's judging Israel benefited the human world as a whole. One, God did judge. Two, it's from the leaders. Three, it did not harm the believers. Four, it was for the believers' protection. Five, it was for the ultimate benefit of Israel and the benefit of the world. So, point one, God did judge Israel. Hosea 9:7, the days of punishment have come. The days of retribution have come. Yes, God's at the smite button. But two, the judgment was for the leaders and rulers. One, in the spiritual realm. Hosea 5:1, hear this, O priests, and to the governmental leaders. Give heed, house of Israel, house of the king, that's the dynasty of the northern kingdom. The judgment applies to you. There we go. How much clearer could he make it? How much more specific could he make it? It's for you. So does he judge his people? Hosea 1:9, the Lord said, you're not my people. All right, there goes that syllogism, doesn't it? The minor premise is incorrect. God judged Israel, major premise. Minor premise, Israel was God's people. No, that's incorrect. Therefore, the conclusion, which is God judges his people, is false. He wasn't judging his people. And I want to make two things clear here. One, they used to be his people. They're not now. What happened? First point is, it was voluntary. They rejected what they knew about looking forward to the Messiah, being saved through him, and they went to idol. God didn't abandon them. They abandoned God. God didn't say, you're not going to be my people first. Before he said, you're not my people, they had said, we don't want to be your people. Second thing I want to make very clear is that a nation, a church can do that, but an individual believer cannot. Once somebody has chosen by an act of his will to believe in Jesus as his Savior, then he's locked in. And even if that individual says, I don't want to be saved anymore, well, that's tough, to use a theological term. It doesn't matter what they say. If they say, I don't believe that anymore, God says, well, I don't care. An individual cannot walk away from it. A nation certainly can. A church certainly can. And that's what happened. So a person cannot stop being God's person. A saved person cannot stop being God's person, but a people who are God's people can certainly stop being his people. But again, it's because they have made that choice. But you see, the judgment was confined clearly to the leaders and the ruler, spiritual and government. Amos gets sort of ugly. Amos, well, I'll tell you what Amos's occupation was, and you'll know. He could get right down to it. He was a fig picker. He picked figs. How many figs could Amos pick? I'm sure there was a riddle they used to say all the time. Amos was from the country, and Amos didn't mince any words. Not very elegant. Amos said, hear this word, you cows of Bashan. I don't know about you, I'm getting negative. Maybe it's just me. You cows of Bashan who are on the mountain of Samaria. Now, Bashan is where the Golan Heights is right now, between Israel and Syria. And they were noted for being what you'd call fat. But they're on the mountain of Samaria. That was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. See what I mean about Amos? Yeah. Hey, you fat cows. Now, why were they fat? They oppressed the poor, they crushed the needy. These fat cows, we would say fat pigs, they say fat cows, they got fat by feeding on believers, by the poor people. They were robbing them and getting fat on them. Micah 2:2, they covet fields and seize them and houses and take them away. They rob a man in his house, a man in his inheritance. That's who's being judged. That's who God put the smite button on. Would you also? Oh, yeah. And Amos and Micah are looking at these fat cows up there walking around full of lard and blubber because they've been robbing poor people. You see, judgment was not on them, on the believers. The judgment was on the fat cows who were robbing the believers. The judgment was for the benefit of the believers to remove the fat cows and their luxurious life. Amos 3:15, I will smite. There we go. I will smite the winter house with the summer house. I guess their houses they had to keep enlarging because they got fatter. The houses of ivory will also perish, and the great houses will come to an end, declares the Lord. Does God have the smite button ready for them? Yes. Now, God doesn't have his sight set on some poor schmuck walking along like that poor guy in the cartoon. But I can just picture God at his computer saying, "Hey, you, fat boy. You coming on the screen? Yeah, I see you. I see you. Stay right there. Hang on. Here we go. Smite." Yeah, all right. God did judge Israel. Secondly, it was on the leaders. Three, it did not harm the believers. Four, it was for their protection. It was for people harming his people. So what did he do? He took them out. And I mean, he took them out. He didn't say, "Let's have a quiet time and think about what you've been doing." He said, "Fat boy, time to get smitten." So that's what happened. God judged Israel. Did God judge his people? No, he's rescuing his people. 2 Kings 17:6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, that's the final king of the northern kingdom, 722 B.C., the king of Assyria, and now that is the king called Sennacherib, S-E-N-N-A-C-H-E-R-I-B, Sennacherib, captured Samaria. Now what happened here when he captured Samaria? God instituted the quickest diet weight loss program in all of history. A lot of fat was removed from the nation of Israel very quickly. All those fat cows were killed. Smite, smite, smite. Now, whenever that happened, whenever Assyria conquered anybody, they always did two things. First, they scattered the inhabitants. That's what they always did. They carried Israel away into exile to Assyria. Names of the places where they took them. They settled them in Halah. If you look on your little map here, follow Israel, see the shaded portion. That's the Fertile Crescent. Follow it up. And just as you follow it up and you see the first little river there, Euphrates River, that would be about where Halah is. In fact, if you see the A in Assyria, see that? Draw a diagonal line 45 degrees till it touches that river Euphrates. That's where Halah was. Second, Habor. All right, see the two S's in the word Assyria? All right, draw a line straight down from the two S's to where it touches that Euphrates River. There's Habor. And then the third place was onto the river of Gozan. Keep on going down the Euphrates. You see the two lakes on either side of the Euphrates? Gozan was right in there. And then the cities of the Medes would have been Babylon. See the little arc they made? Starting with Israel, taking the arc over to Babylon. All right, think about this for a minute. Most of these people scattered were the believers. Now, in a couple of weeks, I'll show you that what God did to Israel, he will do exactly the same thing to Judah later. And where will Judah be taken captive to? To Babylon. So what do you think God's doing here by sending Israelites ahead all the way into Babylon? He's preparing the way so that when the Judahites are dispersed into Babylon, they already have Jewish communities already set up for them. God preparing the way. Assyrians thought they were scattering for their own purposes. God says, "I'm planting my people there." So the Assyrians did what they always do. They scattered the conquered people throughout the nation. By the way, these have been incorrectly called the 10 lost tribes. Mormons, for example, believe that American Indians descended from these lost tribes of the Northern Kingdom. A lot of Mormons left the faith when it was proven that American Indians are Hamitic. They have the same DNA as Africans and Orientals. So also there's some cultic type groups like Garner Ted Armstrong, Herbert W. Armstrong, that church. Many churches teach that the 10 lost tribes actually went to Europe and became the Britons and the Americans. It's more rampant than you would think. Well, there were no lost tribes. We know where they all went. Here's the cities where they went to. And later on in the book of Ezra, we'll see that when Cyrus grants the people in all of his empire the freedom to go back to their homeland, all the 12 tribes are accounted for again. Going a long way there to say, there are no lost tribes. So Assyria did what they always did, scattered them out. And then Assyria always did a second thing. And they did it here. Basically, it's that in reverse. 2 Kings 17:24, the king of Assyria, who's that? That's Sennacherib. He brought men from Babylon. All right, now see, now we're going to do, the ark in reverse. And from Cutha and Ava, see Gozan on your map? That'd be the same place. And from Hamath, that would be Habor. And Sepharvaim, that would be Halah. See what he's doing? He's just retracing the steps. So he dropped people off going out, and then he picked up people, other people from his empire, and did what? And settled them in the cities of Samaria in place of the sons of Israel. Scattered the Israelis out, brought Assyrians back in. So they possessed Samaria and lived in its cities, and now it's called Samaria. It used to be just the capital of Israel. Now the whole area is called Samaria, and that's where the Samaritans came from. So Assyria did that, by the way, for obvious reasons. They would take whenever they'd conquer a nation, they'd scatter them out, and then bring other people from their empire back in. They were trying to mix up different peoples on purpose to suppress rebellion so that people would lose their sense of national identity. But remember, let's put all this together. Judgment came. God did it. God hit the smite button. It was on the leaders. It didn't impact believers. It was for their protection. And point number five, it was for the benefit of Israel specifically, because they were removed from the fat cows who were robbing them. So they were blessed by that. And it was for the benefit of the Judahites, who would be taken captive and taken to Babylon later. But it also benefited the entire world, this conquest of Israel. Well, here's why. Because very quickly after 722 BC, this mighty Assyrian empire became dramatically weak. Very, very quickly. It didn't deteriorate like other empires did. Like, all of a sudden, the Assyrian Empire was drastically weaker. There's no explanation for it, but we know why. Because two things happened to weaken Assyria. First thing that happened is, God now puts Assyria on his computer screen. Uh-oh. And now God puts the smite button on Assyria. Because 2 years later, about the year 720 B.C., in Judah, the southern kingdom, Hezekiah is the king, and Assyria comes and threatens Jerusalem. The king himself, Sennacherib, surrounded Jerusalem. Think about this. The mightiest army in the world is surrounding you. The most cruel army in the world. The army which 2 years earlier has just conquered your northern half. And the Israeli army consisted basically of about four soldiers, and they just had one spear they had to take turns with. So when they saw the armies, the fourth guy said, "I hope it's my day for the spear." Hezekiah goes into his room, kneels down. God said, "Don't worry." So 2 Kings 19:35, God's at the button. Then it happened that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men rose early in the morning, behold, that means wow, all of them were dead. You see, once again, the Bible sheds light on things. Why did the Assyrian Empire become weaker very quickly? Well, something about the angel of the Lord striking down 185,000 of your elite force in one night, that would sort of weaken your army. Well, the king escaped, and he goes back to Nineveh. 2 Kings 19:36, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. That's odd. He always lived at Nineveh. What it says was he stayed at Nineveh. What it means is he never left Nineveh again. I'll show you why he never left Nineveh again. The next verse, 2 Kings 19:37, it came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer killed him with the sword. That's why he never left Nineveh. I'm sure he never got out of the house. It actually says they stabbed him repeatedly. All we know about Adrammelech and Sharezer is that they were his sons. Again, maybe it's just me. I'm thinking there was an element of dysfunctionalism in that family. And they escaped into the land of Ararat. That's where the Japhethites were. So God is at the computer. He's got three other keys now. He's got slash, backslash, and escape.
It took a minute.
Yeah, I knew it would. That's why I gave it. All right, that's the first thing that weakened the Assyrian Empire. And there was a second thing that weakened the Assyrian Empire. Remember, they would disperse the residents outward, and they would bring other people back inward. In their minds, it was to diminish the possibility of rebellion. But in this case, it had an unexpected consequence for them. This was new for the Assyrians. They didn't know it. This was the first time Assyria had ever scattered believers throughout their empire. They didn't know what they were doing. They thought they were discouraging rebellion. What they were doing, they just had the salt shaker out, spreading believers all throughout the Assyrian empire. And their presence alone caused the whole Assyrian culture to change. Cruelty all stopped. And all of a sudden, Assyria just lost its will to conquer people. They didn't know why. Actually, God just let the Assyrians do the easy work of spreading his people around the empire. Now, there's more here. Remember now, many of those believers from Israel who were scattered were sent down to Babylon. Of course, they were preparing the way for their brothers in the south later. But then, what happened in Babylon was the opposite of what happened elsewhere in Assyria. With the presence of the believers now flooding Babylon, all of a sudden Babylon became stronger. In fact, in 600 BC, Babylon, now the small little area of Babylon, conquers the Assyrian Empire. That's inexplicable in history. There's no way to account for it. We know why. Believers there had strengthened the nation of Babylon. So, what are the results of this conquest, Assyria over Israel? Well, the leaders, the fat cows who were hurting the believers, they're removed. They got the smite button. Secondly, believers were taken out into a place of safety. Third, Babylon was prepared as a place for the Judahites. And four, because of all that salt, the world was blessed. And the world was rid of that evil empire of the Assyrians. See how these little minor events, if we look at them through the biblical worldview, have great significance. As we've been seeing, the biblical worldview is history is a control process. God wrote the script. God's directing it. All the world's a stage. And I'm struck by this verse in 1 Corinthians 7:31. It's an odd verse because it's translated so many different ways. King James Version says, "The fashion of this world passeth away." He doesn't mean like, "Girlfriend, that dress is like so last year." That's not what he means. New American Standard, "The form of this world is passing away." I don't even know what that means. Actually, here's what I want to do to the text. I want to provide a clarification and then a correction. First, the word translated form or fashion is actually from the Greek and Roman theater. In fact, it looks kind of like our word scenes. But it's specifically meant to scenes on stage at a theatrical production. All the stage work, the props. In fact, it was kind of a collective term for the succession of scenes within an act and the succession of acts within a play on the theater. That's the form. Secondly, it's not passing away, as in dying. It's moving along. Actually, if Paul were alive today, he would have used an analogy from a movie picture. So the scenes of this world are moving along like scenes in a movie. That's what he's saying. Paul is actually saying what we've been saying. Here's the picture. Yes, all the world's a stage, as Shakespeare said. But all those moving from scenes to scenes, from acts to acts, are really God directing the play that he's already written. Because you see, all this turmoil in the world, it's a control process. It's within those curtains. It's up on that stage. It's all under control. When we're watching a play, if things get out of control, we may enjoy the plot and we may identify with it, but we don't leave shrieking out of the theater, do we? Because we know it's all confined up there on the stage. That's where we ought to look at history. Because see, God rarely uses that smite button, but I tell you the key he uses a lot, and that's the control key, because he's in control of all that. So you see, from our perspective, looking at things of history, some things look traumatic as scenes move along. Armies are destroyed. Kings are killed. Sennacherib was assassinated. Actually, it's God out there in his director's chair, and he's calmly doing this. You're out, you're in. You're out, you're in. So he's going smite, enter, smite, enter, smite, enter. That's him. You're out, you're in. For example, Sennacherib. He went to Sennacherib. Sennacherib, you're out. And where did Sennacherib go? Well, in many classical orchestras, you'll find a big sign up at the front that says, to the pit. That's where Sennacherib went. And normally, that's the way judgment happens. People walk off the stage into the pit themselves. You know, it's kind of odd. We see a whole lot of judgment going on. But Jesus said, I don't judge anybody. Father doesn't judge anybody. Isaiah said it's his very strange work. So we have a whole lot of judgment going on. It's rare that God does it. Most of it is people judging themselves. And here's a little aside, but I couldn't resist. John 3:19, this is the judgment. That clause begins with the word is. Remember?
Depends on what you mean by is.
Remember? In the Greek construction, whenever you have a clause that begins with the word is, remember what that means? That means a formal definition follows. An official definition. If everybody says, what is judgment? Here's the definition. This is judgment, that the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness. The word love means lovingly chose the darkness, rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. There's judgment. When God hits the smite button, it's unusual, it's rare. By far, most judgment is people judge themselves by staying in the darkness because that's where they want to be. You see, there's two worlds available to live in. The world of darkness, that's available to those who have never gone to the cross, never believed that Jesus died on the cross for his or her sin. Those are people living isolated and separated from God. That's the world of darkness. Are they being judged? Yes. Is God judging them? No. They're continuing to judge themselves by living in a world where God doesn't participate in their lives. There's also the world of light available to those who have believed Jesus died on the cross for their sins. And that's where those of us who are believers live. Judgment is continue to walk in darkness. And the normal pattern is they stay in that darkness this life. Now what about hell though? It's exactly the same. At the great white judgment, they walk off the stage, they walk off into the pit, not the orchestra pit, but the pit of hell. And they walk off under their own volition, knowing full well where they're going, because they don't want the light. They judge themselves in this life, and they judge themselves for all of eternity. And for most people who have been in hell, God never once put his finger on the smite button at any time in their whole lives, and he doesn't do it in hell. By far, the vast majority judge themselves. When God does it, it's his strange work. When does God do it then, to put all this together? When does God hit that smite button? There's only one reason. It's not because people are real evil. It's when evil people are harming God's own people. To protect them, God will do his strange work. However, it's easy for us to say, because we can look back on that and see all the benefits of that conquest. But for believers living in Israel, that had to have been a time of great stress, anxiety, and fear. Again, we know the ending. They weren't harmed. They were blessed. But I tell you what, when those armies from an evil empire come to your borders of your country, you're going to be afraid. But that's why the minor prophets kept screaming at them, judgment's coming, it's not going to impact you. It's going to bless you. That's why they kept hammering that. But I'm sure many of them forgot. Or they never got it to begin with. Or again, I guess the army's noise drowned that out. And I can identify with them. I mean, all you got to do is scan the front page of the paper, and it's easy to get afraid when we see things happening in the world. Or things in our lives. Turmoil in our lives. It's easy to start thinking, God's judging me. No, we Christians Christianize it though, remember? We say he's disciplining me. We mean he's punishing me, but we don't have the nerve to say that. So we say he's disciplining. We mean judging, punishing. Again, it's reinforced by what we keep hearing of God sends those trials in our lives to discipline us. How many times have you heard that? That's not true. If we forget what we've just seen, that the only time God judges in our sphere of life is to protect us. It's not directed at us. It's directed at those around us. But it's easy to think, well, it's starting to bleed over onto me, though. Then we become like that psalmist in Psalm 119, I think it was David. Here's a great picture. David says, Psalm 119:83, I have become like a skin in the smoke. Actually, the King James says, I have become like a bottle in the smoke. New American Standard says, like a wineskin in the smoke. That kind of obscures it. It's just a skin in the smoke. What a picture. That picture would correspond to the poor people or nomads. Either people who live in a very small house or people who lived in a tent. Because what they would have in common is they would have no chimney, but in both cases they would have a fire going all the time. Because it was too hard to start another one. If small house, no ventilation, fire always going, you're going to have smoke filling the house all the time. And those people would tend to put their valuables in a skin, a leather skin, and hang it from the top of the dwelling. Well, obviously, as the smoke would come out, that skin would become blackened. It would lose its resiliency, start to wither, shrink, the skin in the smoke. And whenever that would happen, whenever they would notice that it was withered and shrunken up, a very simple way to fix it. Open the door. Let some air and light in. Two key things. Let air in and let light in. And soon, that skin would regain its resiliency. It would gain its fullness again. That picture, when David says, I have become like a skin in the smoke. That picture corresponds to believers who are living specifically in a time where there's turmoil all around. Fires of judgment all around. And the believer is not put into the fire, but he may feel he's being impacted by the smoke. Probably where we are. Well, maybe God's not judging me directly, but he's kind of giving me some collateral stuff here. Maybe he's doing that to whip me into shape. Sounds very holy to say that. I guarantee you, if we think that, we're going to be afraid. So you see, we're not impacted by the fire of judgment. We're impacted by the smoke. And what's the smoke? It's our own fear. We generate our own smoke from worry, anxiety about what's going on, either in the world or more likely what's going on in my life. Is this going to harm me, what's happening in the world or in my life? Is this really going to harm me? Is this going to do damage to me I won't get over? See, what happens, that's fear impacts our flesh, which is our skin. Our flesh, our skin in the smoke. And that fear of what's going to happen causes us to lose our resiliency. We lose our joy, and we become withered because of fear of what God's doing. Fear that these things in the world are going to impact me, my life, my family, or more likely events in my life. They're going to cause me harm. What happens is we forget. First, God rarely judges even the unbeliever. That's rare. So he certainly wouldn't judge me if he rarely judges the unbeliever. And secondly, whenever God hits the smite button, it's always part of a control process to eliminate harm in my life, not cause it, to protect me. But I'm sure many Israelites saw the armies coming and thought, I'm in danger. It's hard not to think that. Minor prophets were saying, no, it's not going to harm you. It may get very close to you. Don't worry about it. If you start worrying about it, the fire won't hit you, but the smoke will hit you. We become like a skin in the smoke. Again, not in the fire, but in the smoke. Our own worry and anxiety. What do we do about it? Well, what did they do about it? They opened the door. They let the light in. And that's what David says. Whenever I get like a skin in the smoke, I don't forget your statutes. Actually, it says, I remember your statutes. What are your statutes? All right, statutes means rules. Oh, but very quickly, let me say, your rules do not refer to rules God gives me. The word statutes refers to rules by which God Himself operates. Otherwise, it didn't make any sense. Whenever I got the blues, I remember all those commandments I'm supposed to do. Yeah, that helps. Oh, yeah. No. Whenever I feel like I'm withering away from fear, a fear that judgment will impact me, then I open the door and let your word in. I remember your statutes, the rules by which you operate. What are the rules by which God operates? I just said, judgment is His strange work. He does not do it to us. When judgment comes around us, it's to kill people around us, frankly. Now, think about it. If you're living in Samaria and you got a lot of fat cows walking around, yeah, judgment's going to come very, very close to you, isn't it? Don't let it bother you. Don't think it's going to impact you, or you'll be like a skin in the smoke. Fire won't hit me. All that can hit me is the smoke. But it's my own smoke. Let the light in. David says, whenever I start getting worried like that, I let your light in. And what did that bring in? Light and air. For us, it's the light of the Word and the wind of Holy Spirit. That will ease that. David says in Psalm 57, David learned over the years, many times, God would start striking people all around him. It took David a long time to catch on. Wait a minute, none of those ever hit me. And also, all those smite buttons you hit are to get evil people out of my way. So David caught on. 57:1, be gracious to me, O God. Be gracious to me, for my soul takes refuge in you. And in the shadow of your wings I will take refuge until destruction passes by. Just like the scenes on the stage. He said, this is just another scene. Keep me safely here in the theater seat until that next one moves by. Psalm 91:5, you will not be afraid of the terror by night. That means things that we don't know that are happening, that are cause us vague fear. You ever had fear of something because you didn't know what was happening? Isn't that ironic? I'm afraid of something because I don't know what's happening. He says, you won't be afraid of those if you remember that I only judge to protect you, or of the arrow that flies by day. Things that we do see that cause us fear. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not approach you. Only the smoke. You will only look on with your eyes. What he's saying is, enjoy the production. Pull up a chair at the theater and watch as the scenes unfold and see what God's going to do. Psalm 91:10, no evil will befall you, nor will any plague come near your tent. Keep the door open. The booger man's not going to get you. God is in charge, scene to scene, outs and ins. You're out, you're in. And you see, He's directing those scenes. And I assure you that right now, we're in the final act of this whole human era. We're in the final act, and we're approaching the final scene. I'll tell you how I know. Because we know, we already have got a picture of the stage on the final act of world history. We've already got a picture of that. And let me tell you who's up there on the stage of the final act of human history. Think about this list in correlation with what you see in a newspaper. Here's the characters on stage for the final act. Israel. The kings of the Far East. Iraq. Iran. Northern Africa, Libya, and Egypt. And you know who's lurking in the wings in the final act of the play? Russia. Golly gee, any of that sound familiar? You know what God's doing? God's saying, I'm assembling the final act. It's not going to impact you. Pull up a chair, enjoy the play. He's setting the scene to take us out of here. Quickly. And until then, God says, if you are believing in my Son, I'll never smite you. Father, again, we thank you for your word, which we don't take for granted. It'd be very easy to take for granted what your word is, but we realize what happened and that you entrusted it to the family of Shem, and here it is delivered to us. Thank you for that, and we thank you for your providence in that happening. That's why we have pictures of events such as this that shed light on human history and what light you show us. That when you judge, when you're at the smite button, it's for your purposes. It's never to harm your own people. Protect us. We've been delivered from judgment. Above all, we thank you for Jesus, whose death on the cross satisfied all judgment. He's the one who passed through the fire of judgment, so we don't have to, and we thank you in His name this morning. Amen.